everybody. Bienvenue. The rest is history. Tom, lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you, as ever. Your happy face, smiling.
You're doing an audiobook at the moment, aren't you?
I am recording Rubicon this week, and then a couple of months later, I'm recording Dynasty.
Oh, really?
So that all the three books and series.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been revisiting books that we wrote a long time ago, because the series out at the moment on 1974, obviously you were drawing from two books that you wrote. So State of Emergency and Seasons in the Sun.
Yeah, yonks ago.
I'm quite enjoying reading Rubicon. But I realised there's quite a lot that I'd forgotten.
Right.
And I was wondering how much you forget.
Oh, loads.
So when you had to prepare your notes for 1974, I mean, was it all just in your head?
No. I've forgotten loads. Loads of the details. I mean, so I would have done the research for State of Emergency in about 2008, I guess. 2009 or 2007 even. That's a long time ago, Tom.
It is.
I mean, you're not going to remember all those details. My question for you, though, is you don't generally do your own audiobooks, do you? This is a novelty for you. Is that right?
No, I've never done it. I did it for PAX.
Yeah.
And I think the thinking for that was that people who listen to this podcast might prefer to hear me read it.
Yes.
Because my voice now would be better known.
Yes.
Because previously people wouldn't know what I sounded like.
That's true.
And now they would. So it would be a bit odd.
Yeah.
And the only other time I did it was the preface and the very last section of Dominion, because they were personal.
Yeah.
So I was kind of talking about my own beliefs.
All right. Okay.
And again, it maybe would have been a bit odd having
someone else had done that.
Someone else ventriloquize it.
So I did Who Dares Wins. That was 2 weeks, 3 weeks in the studio.
Was that the first one you'd done, or had you done all of the others?
No, I haven't done any of the others. So at that point, State of Emergency and Seasons of the Sun were done by an actor who did some of the voices, actually. He did Harold Wilson and he did Ted Heath and so on.
Did he? Was his Edward Heath as good as mine?
He's regarded as very good.
So.
But it's weird listening to someone reading it because they never read it as you would read it, I would say. So then I did Who Dares Wins, and that just seemed to take forever because it's like 360,000 words.
I know, it's a long book.
And now, finally, I'm very happy to say that the first ones are going to be done. Never Had It So Good in White Heat. But again, they're 350,000 words each.
So is it on the same principle as me, that people now know what you sound like?
No, I'm not doing them. I haven't got time.
Oh, right. Okay.
So basically the thing with those was, they were like, does Dominic want to do them? And, you know, it would be basically at least 2 weeks for each book. So it's a month out of my life. And I haven't got a spare month, Tom.
So Rubicon was read by Andrew Sachs.
Really?
Who will be
Manuel,
best known to people as Manuel on Fawlty Towers.
I think he should have read it in his Manuel voice.
Well, so I realised, I mean, I've never listened to it.
Right.
Why would I? I've already heard it. I mean, I know what it's in it.
Yeah.
I realised that lurking in the back of my mind was the assumption that he'd done it in a kind of Manuel accent. It had just kind of been lurking there. Yeah, so I imagine he must have done it very well. He was a very good actor.
Yeah, he was a good actor.
But I'm enjoying doing it because the strain of melodrama in Rubicon is pretty strong.
Right.
So it's quite fun to read.
Yeah.
So there's lots of stuff about curses and blood and all kinds of things.
It's quite boring though, isn't it, doing an audiobook? Do you not think?
No, I'm quite enjoying it.
You've only done it for a day though, Tom. I mean,
you enjoy it for about an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the word starts kind of shimmering in front of your gaze.
They do.
I forget how to pronounce certain words.
Right.
You see a word kind of coming at you down the paragraph. And suddenly, how the hell do I pronounce that?
But there are also words that you've never used.
Yeah, exactly. Aren't there?
That you've never said.
And you realise you've been mispronouncing.
Right. We did the audiobook of The Rest is History, of course.
Yeah, we did.
Both together and separately. And that was a very strange experience, wasn't it? I found that very peculiar, reading that out.
I enjoyed the opportunity for accents in that.
You did. Well, they told me, because when I did my separate day, they said, are you going to do this bit in an accent? And it was, I think, the one where you were voicing Theodora.
Yeah, as an Essex girl.
Yes. Anyway, this is Witter that's not answering questions. But anyway, you're enjoying it, Tom.
Yeah.
How many more weeks have you got to do of it?
I'm just doing it this week. So I should get Rubicon done this week.
Okay, well, it just takes a week to do Rubicon.
It's about 135,000 words, so it's about a third of yours.
It's a pamphlet. It's just a pamphlet, Tom. Shocking. It's a mere leaflet.
A century of some of the most famous history in the world.
Yeah.
135,000.
But State of Emergency is 3.5 years.
That's the difference between us.
Yeah. A lot happened in the early 70s, to be fair. All right.
Yeah.
Let's do some questions. Let's see if we can get through loads and loads of questions.
Okay.
Because sometimes I know people complain that the bonus episodes are too short. And by the way, we are totally blameless in this regard, aren't we, Tom? Because we would love to do them for hours.
Yeah. It's just Theo cracking the whip.
But Theo, who gets a lot of grief these days on Discord, he says it's out of compassion for Tabby, who has to edit it. But I think it's actually Theo. Anyway, right. Tom, Nathan Hogg has a question for you.
Yes.
It comes off your wonderful episodes about Richard II. He says, how much did Richard's childlessness affect his eventual overthrow? And that's an important point.
I'm not sure it did, actually, because I think it may have impeded the willingness, if anything, of Bolingbroke to overthrow him. Because the analogous situation is with Isabella and Mortimer wanting to overthrow Edward II.
Oh, yes.
So Isabella was Edward II's queen,
yeah,
in association with Mortimer, her lover. You know, who would they have put on the throne if not Edward II's son, the young Edward III and future top lad, you know, Edward III?
Yeah.
So had Richard II had a son, it might have made the whole situation much easier.
It would, wouldn't it? Now that I think about it, because people are always being toppled and replaced by their son, aren't they? That's a pretty standard move.
Particularly if it's a young child that you can then dominate.
Yeah, that you can control.
Use as a kind of proxy.
Yes, exactly. So actually it means that the stakes are higher.
Although, I mean, I suppose an interesting question is what impact it had on Richard psychologically, and we can't know.
Why does he have no heir? Why does that not play on his mind?
His first queen, whom he loved very much, I think couldn't have children.
Right.
She dies, and he then marries another queen, but she's quite young. So I think she's 12 or 13.
Okay.
So probably too young to have children.
So he's thinking that with time.
With time, yeah, I think so. So I don't think he would have given up.
But it's not an anxiety for him.
Imagine, it must be. I mean, the prime duty of a king is to have an heir.
Yeah.
So it must have been, it must have weighed on him. Hmm. And maybe it accentuated his concern to play the role of a king. I mean, I think Shakespeare's play really accurately actually gets that sense of him.
Yeah.
That he is very, very self-aware in his role-playing as a king.
Hmm.
And it seems to be bred to a degree of a sense that he has not been the king that his grandfather, Edward III, had been.
Yeah, yeah.
And Edward III, of course, had multitudes of sons. So maybe that was another thing that that weighed on him. I don't know. I mean, we're doing the kind of cod psychologizing.
Yeah, but we love it though, Tom. I mean,
of course we do. We can do it on a bonus, probably not in the actual episode.
I do an episode.
Yeah, we could.
All right. Oh, God, this is really another one for you because I can't remember who any of these people are. Simon Girdleston, which of Chaucer's pilgrims do you think I would be? And then the same question, which do I think you would be?
Well, we kind of discussed this actually in the episode because I said that Chaucer had quite a Sandbrookian interest.
Yeah. So you're saying I'd be Chaucer?
Well, I think you do have a Chaucerian quality. I think you are interested in the broad range of society and you are very good at kind of homing in on what is funny about people at different layers of society.
Well, that's nice, Tom. Thank you.
So I think I'm flattering you to a degree there, comparing you to one of the greatest poets in the English language.
Yeah, I'll take it. I'll take it. Did he do his own audiobook? No. I could do it, though.
But I think within the Canterbury Tales, probably Harry Bailey, who is...
So the landlord.
He's the landlord. He's kind of the ringmaster for the pilgrims.
Right.
He doesn't suffer men of the cloth kindly.
Right.
So he's always kind of telling people off if they go on for too long. So maybe him.
Oh, okay, that does sound, yeah. But the trouble is, Tom Girdleston wants me to say who I think you are, and are you the wife of Bath? I mean, that's pretty much the only character I can remember.
Well, apart from the fact I'm not a woman and I'm not from Bath, I mean, the parallels leap out. I'm not in the habit of wearing red, I don't have a gap tooth, and I haven't been married five times.
I'm just naming tales. The Pardoner or something?
The Pardoner, thanks, Dominic.
I don't know who the Pardoner is.
He's an absolute shit.
I see, oh.
Yeah, he's horrible.
The Miller? I mean, you're not the Miller, are you?
I'm not the Miller. I don't know.
Okay. I think you're just the spirit of the book itself, aren't you?
Oh, Dominic, thank you.
Isn't that nice?
All right. Okay, here's one for you.
Yeah.
Athelfrith, how quickly did the 1960s get the legendary reputation they have today? Was it almost instant or did it take a while to develop?
Great question. The first books about the 60s were written in the 70s. That's both in Britain and in America. And there were elements of the 60s that were mythologized, I think, very quickly. So I've obviously done a very famous one, the assassination of Kennedy and the Kennedy era is mythologized almost straight away. The talk of Camelot, books about Kennedy are published instantly.
Summer of Love as well.
Summer of Love, of course, at the time, yes.
I mean, all the hippies, you know, they're kind of sitting there thinking, wow, we're groovy.
Yeah. The events of 1968, people are very conscious that it's an extraordinary year. There's a sense of momentum to the events of the événement in Paris become as part of a sort of folk legend almost pretty much straight away. And the sense of the 60s as a cultural battleground, I think by the 70s, that's definitely become embedded. So there are books, like I'm just thinking about in Britain, Bernard Levin wrote a book called The Pendulum Years. Christopher Booker wrote a book called The Neophiliacs. These were books about saying, we have lived through this bizarre moment. I mean, both of those writers basically say a moment of complete hysteria, you know, when society just went mad. That's how they see it. The funny thing is, I think a lot of that stuff doesn't really bear much relation to most people's lives. But I do think that very quickly, the 60s are mythologized so that when you get to the 1980s, conservative politicians like Ronald Reagan, or especially in Britain, Margaret Thatcher and Norman Tebbit, are using the 60s as a shorthand for, you know, licentiousness, obscenity, the degeneration of morality. I mean, that's in such a short period of time, Tom. That's like if we were talking about the 2000s or the early 2010s or something. I mean, we don't do that. Obviously, there's no sense that we have, I think, of a very recent period of history having a personality and entering into legend in the same way, but they definitely have that. Go on.
I mean, it works the other way. So the great film about the 60s, which you haven't seen, with Nell and I, ends with the drug dealer saying mournfully at the end of the film, they're selling hippie wigs in Woolworths.
Right.
And the sense that everything that made the 60s groovy is now being commodified and cheapened and, you know, it's no longer cool. But I wonder about the music, because I think the music is incredibly important in conveying a sense of the 60s as the 60s.
Yes.
And again, I think that there is a sense in the 60s itself that this music is incredible. And you just have to hear certain songs to immediately conjure up an image of the 60s.
Yeah.
And I think that because it's so distinctively associated with that decade in a way that has had a kind of diminishing return since the 60s, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
And also the look. So we talked about the fashion.
Yeah.
They serve as...
Yeah, signifiers.
There's a kind of semiotic intensity to it.
Yeah, totally they do. And on the music is interesting because obviously the music is, if for people of a certain age, music is absolutely integral to their sense of living through what they see as an extraordinary cultural moment. And there is undoubtedly a sense, I think it's, you can date it pretty precisely. It is round about the time the Beatles break up. So let's say it's between 1969 and 1971, where people say that era has ended. You know, what is the next thing? And actually, if you, because I've read all these, you know, the New Musical Express, Melody Maker and all that stuff from that period. And there are tons and tons of editorials and things where people will say, we have lived through something amazing. What's coming next?
Mm.
And they will sort of lament. This is like the summer of 1971 or 1972. They will lament and say the Beatles and the Stones, I mean, actually the Rolling Stones are still going.
About to enter their golden age, aren't they?
Yeah, they are indeed. The Rolling Stones are actually going to reach their peak in about 1973. But people are sort of saying, well, it's not quite what it was. It's lost some of the fun. They've got a sense of the 60s suddenly becoming a slightly oppressive standard that they're going to struggle to live up to.
Is that because the decade has ended or because the Beatles have broken up? Or what is it that is making them think that? Because the Stones and the Who as well, I mean, they have their best albums in the early 70s.
They're still going, yes, of course. Yeah. So why is it? I don't think it's just a quirk of the clock. I mean, obviously there's a tiny element of that, but I don't think it's just because the number has shifted from 6 to 7. I do think part of it is the Beatles, who are totally dominated the narrative, are gone. So there is a sense of loss. But also I think what that in itself represents is the fact that there's been a big generational shift.
Mm.
I don't think people think about this enough when they write about these periods.
Yeah.
Imagine that you were, what was the perfect age to have fallen in love with the Beatles? I guess being 18 in 1963?
No, a bit younger, maybe 14.
Maybe 14. Let's compromise and say 16 in 1963. So by 1970, you are 23.
Yeah, you're taking out a mortgage.
And at that point...
You're buying your washing machine. You're getting the full Sambrook.
You are. Statistically, you are probably getting married round about that point. And as you say, getting a mortgage. And I think at that point, I mean, don't forget people in that... Certainly this is true of my parents. I'm guessing of lots of our listeners' parents as well. They grew up very fast and put away childish things.
But Dominic, this is why you've got to see With Nell and I. This is what it's about.
Right.
It's about one of them moves on, gets a job, moves out, and the other one doesn't.
Like Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads, Dom.
Yeah, it is. It is the same. Yeah.
That's the plot of Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads. Anyway, going back to the 23 thing, I think that is key to the sense of loss and of a shift and things not being as good again. Because we all feel like that, don't we? When we look back at our teens, we say, gosh, I'll never recapture that sense of excitement and enthusiasm and innocence and all of that business. So I think that's a big, big part of it. Sorry, this has ended up being just a big rant.
No, not at all. No, it's fascinating. Very good point. And just to reiterate, you must watch With Natalie. You really must.
Okay, yeah.
It's what this is about.
It has become such a key part of our off-screen dynamic, Tom, that I don't know what we talk about.
Well, maybe you have secretly watched it and you're just pretending. I don't know.
Just humouring you.
Yeah, just humouring me.
Okay, Peter Sarkis. Did people in medieval England visit Hadrian's Wall out of interest in the Romans?
That is a very good question. So Bede references it, but Bede isn't visiting it. He is living in its shadow because he's in Jarrow and Hadrian's Wall is on the other side of the Tyne. So he's well aware of it. There is a report, I think in Life of St. Cuthbert actually, of a Roman water fountain that is clearly regarded as a kind of local wonder that people do go and see. The wall is marked on medieval maps of Britain, so people are clearly aware of it. It remains a very formidable physical presence on the landscape. But I think, I may be wrong on this, I think the earliest records we have of people who are going to visit it isn't until the Tudor period. So there's John Leland, who I think end of the 1530s, maybe early 1540s, he is compiling a great record of the antiquities.
So he's a kind of antiquarian.
Yeah, of England, and he visits Hadrian's Wall and records it. And then going into the kind of the second half of the 16th century, there are quite a lot of kind of local clergymen who are writing it up.
Right.
But generally, I think it seems to be in the 16th century that you get the kind of the conscious antiquarianism.
Is it true that people would have thought that Hadrian's Wall or the ruins of Bath or whatever, that they would have been built by giants?
No. Bath, maybe in the early post-Roman period. That's the famous poem, isn't there, that refers to it being built by giants. But Hadrian's Wall, people always know. They don't know that it's Hadrian who built it.
Yeah, of course.
They think it's a Septimius Severus who built it, Roman emperor, who led a kind of genocidal invasion of Caledonia, Scotland.
Right.
So they think he builds it. But they always know that it's the Roman Wall.
Yeah.
They call it the Roman Wall.
Yeah. All right.
So here's one for you.
Yeah, go on.
Lambert Simnel-Cate, what's the worst policy decision a British PM ever made?
So many to choose from. The rest of politics have been involved with some of these decisions, haven't they? I think we've talked about it very recently, Tom, and this week, in fact. It is, of course, Ted Heath's messing around with the counties.
Yeah.
The traditional counties. You'd want to reverse that, wouldn't you?
A terrible stain on British history.
Avon.
Humberside.
Yeah.
Rutland just wiped off the map with a stroke of the pen.
So actually, do you know what? We were just saying about my books are too long. So I wrote a section for White Heat that ended up being cut because my editors at your publisher, Tom Little Brown, said, no one has any interest in this. And it was about what happened to Rutland.
I'd have been interested in that.
Because Rutland was going to be destroyed. People have been talking about wiping Rutland off the map for a decade. You know, Whitehall pen pushers had been wanting to get rid of it and there were protest meetings. There was a protest movement in Rutland, Tom. Kind of save Rutland.
It's absolutely the kind of thing that would appeal to me.
Yeah. So for people who don't know, Rutland is Britain's smallest county, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it was, but it features prominently in Shakespeare's history plays. He's one of the brothers of Edward IV, I think. He gets murdered by Margaret of Anjou, I think.
Is that right?
I think so. When York, the Duke of York, gets captured.
Oh, yes, you're quite right.
After Wakefield, and Rutland gets killed.
Yes, he does. 17.
And Margaret of Anjou, in the play, kills him and dabbles her fingers in his blood.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's part of our literary as well as our historical heritage.
Crikey.
Anyway, Dominic, this is a question that is also focused by the episodes of 1974 and on recent British history, which is actually, to what extent does any decision by a British Prime Minister make much difference? Or is the country just being swept on great economic and geopolitical tides that
question, Tom.
Really we can do nothing much about?
Well, Tom, I mean, the trouble is that on the answer to that question hangs the relevance or otherwise of my books about 3 years of British history.
Not really, because it's interesting. I mean, whether it...
Yeah, it matters. It's interesting, but it doesn't matter. I think it's probably my answer. I don't think it does matter. And the example I always think of is, I think we might have said this before in the podcast, and if so, I apologize to people who are bored of hearing it. If you had said to a German in 1900, one of the characters in Thomas Mann's book, Buddenbrooks, or their descendants, you know, some prosperous merchant in Lübeck eating marzipan, and you had said, this is what's going to happen to Germany. You're going to fight this titanic world war and be absolutely smashed at the end of it. Then you have a revolution. You have years of chaos and paramilitaries and stuff. Then you'll be taken over by the worst people in all history. they will fight a genocidal war in which your entire country will just be plunged into the abyss, such that when the war ends, it's year zero. Your cities will have been leveled. Millions of people turn into refugees. Utter death and destruction.
Country split in two.
Yeah, country split in two, and half of it ruled by communists for the next 40 years. Where do you think you'll be at the beginning of the 21st century? And no one would ever say they'd be where they are now, right? People would assume that they would never recover from that. But countries are much more, there's an extraordinary resilience, I think. And the vicissitudes, it seems weird that I would be describing two world wars, the Third Reich,
yeah,
the GDR as surface froth or as vicissitudes. But actually, Germany right now is Europe's, you know, biggest, most economically dynamic. It's the great motor of Europe, the indispensable nation of Central Europe. So in a weird way, I mean, there were some pretty bad decisions by German politicians in that period. Maybe none of them, I mean, they matter at the time, but in the great long run.
So Theo has commented in the thing, they're still better off than Britain.
That's a bit harsh. I mean, they're not British, Tom, so that's a big black mark for them.
So we've got an election coming up in Britain later this year.
Yeah.
And of course, the default assumption is that the present government is terrible.
Yeah.
So it's going to lose because the perception is that it's been incredibly incompetent,
yeah,
and terrible and run the country into the ground. But a heretical thought, I mean, would it have made any difference at all what government had been in power? Maybe Britain, like other countries, is simply a leaf being blown on mighty gales. Maybe you have to be America or China, perhaps, to create your own destiny. But even then,
right,
countries the size of France, Britain, Germany, to what extent, whoever had been in power over the past 15 years, would they have done any better? Kind of questioning the whole basis of,
yeah,
democracy and,
yeah,
and, you know, does it make any difference at all?
I think that's a very valid question, Tom. So first of all, on it being the worst government or whatever, people always say that at the end of any Tory government. Britain has a pattern where it has conservative governments that are in for a very long period of time. And at the end of their time in office, the media just sort of turn on them, as it were.
But it would be the same with any government, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Like the same thing with the SNP in Scotland now.
Yeah, the people did that about Gordon Brown.
Yes, with Labour, yeah.
He could do no right. And even the smallest gaffe or whatever, you know, Gordon Brown could sort of forget to sign his name at the bottom of a document and people would say,
there you go.
You know, he's got to go. Exactly. I mean, the one thing that obviously hangs in the air is Brexit, because Brexit is a big thing. Although, having said that, my view of Brexit has always been, this will scandalize all our listeners, whatever their preference, that actually doesn't matter as much as everybody thinks, because I think in the long run, and I'm talking about 50 years plus, Britain and its relationship with Europe will probably end up ultimately effectively the same place that it was anyway, whether it's
semi-detached.
Yeah, whether it's technically in or technically out. And it's an argument that will, as it were, never end. But I do, of course, I agree with you to some degree. And often when I'm seeking to annoy people by giving talks, I'm asked about Thatcherism or the 1980s, which is obviously one of my big things. I will often say, you know, everyone either thinks Margaret Thatcher is the savior or she's the witch, but what if she actually doesn't matter at all? What if everything was going to happen anyway?
Okay, so here's one. What about Britain entering the First World War?
Yeah.
They could have stayed out and that would have made a huge difference.
Yes, it would have done. So I do think when it comes to decisions about war in particular, I mean, a war is a crisis, an emergency. Just, I mean, quite apart from the sort of diplomatic element, the amount of economic mobilization, the complete disruption to your economic and social fabric of a war puts it beyond anything else, even a pandemic. So the two world wars, or the Napoleonic Wars before them, those are existential issues. You know, there are existential questions for Roman emperors, aren't there? Most Roman emperors don't matter, but Heraclius, let's say, does.
But the Napoleonic Wars and the Second World War, it was forced on Britain, really. I mean, Britain didn't really want to go to war in either case. The First World War, there was a choice.
Yes.
They could have not gone into it.
Right. I mean, you know my views on this, Tom.
I do. So that's why I'm asking you whether you think that that is the worst policy decision.
Oh.
Because it is one where Britain genuinely had agency.
Britain does have agency, but I'm hesitant to say the worst because I think there are really good reasons to enter the First World War.
Fine. All right.
So I completely understand where they're coming from. I think they chose wrongly. But I totally understand. I think it was a completely reasonable and justifiable decision. Now I'd contrast that with, let's say, Iraq.
So what about policies over the Irish famine?
That's not a PM's policy, though, I wouldn't have said, is it? There's a guy called Trevelyan, isn't there, who is involved with that.
But, you know, better things could have been done.
Absolutely. So in other words, if you're rerunning that scenario in a video game, you're never going to do it.
Because that's another way of framing it, is it's not bad for, say, the country.
Mm-hmm. It's bad for somebody else's country.
Well, but Ireland was a part of the United Kingdom at that point. So it was a part of the country.
It was.
So to condemn millions of people in your own country, the country for which you have responsibility as the government, I can't think of a worse decision, actually.
But actually, the interesting thing there, which goes back to the essence of the question implies that it's British prime ministers that make decisions. But actually, the Irish famine is a good example where it's not the prime minister who necessarily makes that decision. It's a governing culture. It's a kind of institutional culture of prejudice, obsession with kind of sort of free markets, liberalism and so on, an indifference to suffering when it's on the other island, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And actually, that's not about a single British prime minister. And Lambert Simnel-Kate's question, which is, I mean, I'm not dissing him at all or his question, but when we think about politics, to go back to your earlier point, you know, I always think we think of it as like a Bond villain, kind of pressing buttons and factories blowing up and stuff happening. But prime ministers actually have so little power, have so little agency. The government as a whole has some agency, but the number of things that happen purely because of a particular one person's decision in a successful democracy, that shouldn't really happen. It does happen, obviously, in dictatorships. Hitler makes a decision, don't leave Stalingrad, and they stay, disaster. But in a democracy where you've got functioning institutions playing off each other and, you know, tensions and all that kind of stuff, that shouldn't be how it works. I mean, maybe actually it's an interesting question. So obviously Donald Trump has made a difference in American politics in a way that most American politicians, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, you know, they didn't matter at all. George W. Bush invades Iraq. But is that George W. Bush's personal decision? Or is it, again, that's an institutional thing? If he's not president, there are loads of other Republicans who would do it.
Well, but on that, Britain's decision to join in that is pretty much Tony Blair's decision.
Yes and no. He pushes it very enthusiastically. But any British prime minister is in a really difficult spot at that point.
I understand that. But essentially, it comes down to him. You know, he is given an out on that.
Yeah, he could have chosen differently.
On which topic?
Yeah.
And we have to stop because Theo is worrying about Tabby.
He hates the bonus episodes.
It's for Tabby. But of course, with questions like this, there is always the impulse for us to assume that things that happen closest to us are the most important. So people might say Brexit or Iraq or whatever.
Yeah. Foreign policy. We're choosing foreign policy things.
But clearly, these are not significant compared to things in the past. And again, this was something that struck me in responses to the claim that 1974 was the worst year in British.
Oh, yeah.
People say, but what about 2022 or 2016?
Yes,
I mean, I was kind of thinking, you know, there weren't bombs going off.
Yeah, I know.
Every day in a part of the United Kingdom.
The narcissism with our own times.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you know, we did that wonderful stuff with Dan Jackson and Paul Rouse about Ireland and Britain. And that stuff about Britain in the late 1900s and early 1910s. I mean, again, like paramilitaries marching in the streets.
I know, amazing.
Civil war looming.
Yeah.
All of that kind of thing. And totally forgotten now and just seems like an irrelevant nonsense.
Yeah.
Whereas our own troubles, you know, the premiership of Liz Truss, which in the grand scheme of things, it's not even a footnote.
The merest blip.
Yeah. It's barely even a word in a book. We think, oh, massively important. Everyone will talk about that in hundreds of years. They won't. Nobody will ever have heard of it.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll still be, I'm sure, cranking out episodes in 100 years' time.
Yeah. About irrelevant bits of history. Yeah.
But for now, I think that's enough.
Do you want to tell people what's coming? Because we've got something very exciting coming.
Oh, yes, we should do that, shouldn't we?
We don't want to give too much away, obviously, because people will be listening from History Hit. But
so you've got 1974 at the moment.
Yeah.
We've got
Carthage.
Four episodes on Carthage.
Can't wait for that.
Building up to the First Punic War.
Yeah.
But the first episode is on the Phoenicians.
Yeah.
The second one is on the history of Carthage itself.
Yes.
The third one is on the rise of Rome and relations with Carthage. And the fourth one is the Punic War and the war against the mercenaries.
Those last episodes are absolutely brilliant. If you like blood-soaked mercenaries behaving very badly.
They behave very badly.
Then those episodes are for you. And then we've got a complete change of tone, haven't we, with our episode on the history of chocolate.
That was fun.
That was very fun.
And then we've got an episode that we recorded yesterday, which is History's Top Monkeys, which is also great fun.
Yes.
History of monkeys and apes.
Yeah. So there's a big discussion.
But not Homo sapiens.
Yeah. So we've got baboons in there. We've got macaques. We've got all kinds of primates.
Anyone who's listening to this who is maybe an eminent zoologist will
be horrified.
I suspect be appalled.
Yeah, but we've got lots of stuff going on. So you've got Roman army. We've got people fighting the First World War.
We've got bubbles.
Yeah, we've got Michael Jackson. We've got 1820s fighting pits.
We've got artistic monkeys.
We've got Darwin. There's a lot going on.
Football mascots.
Yes.
Then we have episodes we haven't yet recorded. So we've got the Titanic coming up.
I'm doing the notes for that today, Tom.
We've got Luther.
I won't be doing any notes for that.
We've got the fall of Singapore.
Yeah.
And then we've got, marking the 200th anniversary of his death, we've got Lord Byron. So lots to come.
Yeah, lots of very good fun things. Okay, thank you all for listening. Thank you, as always, for all your support and for all your questions. And we will see you on a live stream very soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.